Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 4th of September, 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. I don't know about you, but it was great to see all the kids out waiting for the bus this morning. Oh, wasn't that nice? They're getting ready for their first day of school.
And Facebook is really great, too, filled with first day of school pictures. Yeah. I love that.
It is really fun. The little kids are so cute. They have their, bandages. No, they have those big placards that tell them, you know, how old they are, their name, whose class they're in. And I think that's always very cute.
Bulletproof backpacks now.
It's adorable.
So cute.
Kevlar. Yeah. The Kevlar vest the kids are wearing. It's just back to school attire. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome. A little ray of sunshine in your day. Let me introduce the panel to you. We have a terrific group. We have a lot to talk about. Big stories, big news, and a big panel. So let's go. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, my friend. We're fine. We've been using FaceTime to check in with our two grandchildren as they do the first day of school. It's really extraordinary to watch the bright faces and how well they're doing.
It's fun, especially when they're young in that age. And then I was there's these three kids that live on a road I go down right by my house. And I'd say the oldest one is a junior and maybe the youngest one is a freshman. And they just looked like, come on, really? It was great.
You all remember Forrest Gump, of course.
Yes.
The first day of school. Yeah, sure.
Well, it's exactly. And so those are highs and lows, but it's still very, very fun to watch it. And now our days of getting into work in under an hour are shot to hell. But that's all right. Terry Gibson is here. He is a former New York State senator. He is a professor at SUNY New Paltz. And where else are you a professor at? Is it in RPI?
Any place it'll take me, I'm happy to teach there. No, I do. I do some adjunct work at RPI, and I've been down at Westchester Community College, and I've been.
But right now it's all New Paltz.
It's all about New Paltz.
All right,
all day long, I'm there in the communications department. Happy to be there. Happy to be here. I'm glad we have ventured away from the dark humor that we were starting off with this morning, and maybe moving to a happier place. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
God.
No, I doubt that. But we'll give it a shot.
He's playing the cheery optimist. Say we have one of those every day now.
Well, somebody's got to play that role.
It's part of the mix that Joe
works to get. Yeah.
One
okay.
pessimist, one optimist. Alan will beat it out of him before the show's over.
For some reason, and I don't know why this is, Rosemary, but ever since you've come back, I have to find more optimists. It's the strangest thing.
We're doomed. It doesn't matter.
Times Union columnist Chris Churchill joins us. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Wonderful to see you. And Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, everybody.
Wonderful to have you here. All
it's
right.
It's good to be here.
We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So we are going to start off with Dorian because the storm is, again, dangerously close to Florida and Georgia, and we're still waiting to see what happens. But what has happened is images are now coming out of the Bahamas. We were sort of bracing yesterday when we talked because we were hearing reports, but we had not yet seen pictures. Now there's aerial footage and cell phone footage and so forth of the devastation in the Bahamas, and it is really bad. It is a disastrous outcome, is how the Prime Minister put it. Desperate residents stranded on rooftops amid swirling currents, rescue efforts stalled by flooded vehicles and roads turned to rivers, communications in ruins, and basic infrastructure, including shelters, hospitals, and public buildings, underwater. And all around, vicious winds and crashing waves brought on by Hurricane Dorian, one of the most powerful storms recorded in the Atlantic, whipped the low-lying islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama in the northwestern Bahamas for a second day on Tuesday. The true extent of Dorian's toll was only beginning to emerge as the storm began to pull away. Entire neighborhoods were reduced to unrecognizable fields of rubble. Houses were crushed into splinters and boats were tossed into heaps like toys. Video from a helicopter flyover showed this. About 60% of Grand Bahama was underwater. The satellite company, a satellite company that tracks this, said that yesterday. That includes the airport all around. Massive waves curled toward the island, delivering new blows as time went on. And the Minister of National Security for the Bahamas says it's not just the power and ferocity of the storm, it's also the length of time it's spent over Abaco and Grand Bahama. It is a disastrous outcome. Seven people have died in Abaco, according to the Prime Minister, although the toll is expected to climb. Children were among those killed, and again, more is expected once they start working their way through. Bob, do you want to start off as far when it comes to emergency preparedness and how we and how we go into a situation like this, and ultimately what our role is here in this country?
I do, although Joe, I would be remiss if we didn't recognize Rosemary is on the panel today as well. So I just want to make sure that.
Yeah, you
did forgot. I skip you?
You yes, did, but that's okay because I was interrupting through the whole time, so I figure people know I'm here.
So that was
I'm here.
That was a little bit of prevention.
That is emergency preparedness.
For Hurricane Rosemary hit. You know, Joe, you know, one of the reasons we have a college like we do about emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity is just because of the situation. You know, how we start to train the next generation of leaders to deal with crises like this, because what happened in the Bahamas, it is thankfully it doesn't appear like it's going to occur on mainland because of Dorian, but it will at some point. Right now, the survivors of the Bahamas are struggling to figure out when and if aid is coming. You know, for the officials down there, they're struggling with how do you start to bring in needed supplies. And for those of you that sort of understand that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're really at the bottom. I mean, we're talking about shelter. We're talking about clean water. We're talking about food, basic medicine. And when you look at the Grand Bahamas, and you said you talked about the death toll on Abaco, that it's going to rise substantially. And once you start to hit that third day without food and medicine and water, you're also going to start to see the not only increased death, but also disease and additional injuries. It's going to be very, very grim there until we can start to move resources.
The you know, one of the things Rosemary meant, both Rosemary and I mentioned this yesterday, was that there was a BBC report that we had on pretty much all morning. They were talking about these satellite images of these trucks filled with bodies, but none of that has been reported now. They're still saying seven, and so I don't know if that toll is just going to go astronomical or.
I think so. I think right now they just don't have enough communications. Back to the islands to really understand what the impact is. But when you look at Abaco and you realize that I think the highest point of the island is 30 feet above sea level, and the tide was, I think, approximately 23 to 27 feet, you know, you're talking about an unmitigated disaster. And the other part of the problem that I think people need to understand is that even for the families that prepared, so even for the families that had food and water in their go kits and had done everything right that the emergency preparedness folks were telling them to do, the extent of the damage for both their homes and cars has pretty much destroyed all of those stocks. So they're actually lucky to survive with just the clothes on their back. And while it seems like you're surrounded by water, there is nothing to drink. And if you think about the hot Caribbean sun while you're on top of a roof surrounded by water, it must be a horrifying existence for folks down there.
So can we not live in the Bahamas anymore? Are these islands and the others like them and around Florida and Georgia, should we just be abandoning them now? Because this is not going to – if we rebuild it, won't this happen again? Quite likely?
You know, I think so. I think if you listen to researchers in atmospherics, and we're blessed at UAlbany in New York to have some really strong atmospherics programs, the effect of climate change is real. And this is one element of climate change that scientists have been predicting that we're starting to see is not only the severity and frequency of hurricanes, it's the fact that their natures are starting to change in the sense of they're moving slower, which means that the amount of damage that they're coming, the amount of tide that they're bringing with them. So what you're hitting on is that areas, both in the islands, but also if you start to think on our coastal communities, are going to be threatened. The scary part, though, is that that's not just islands or the Outer Banks of North Carolina. It's starting, if you look at D.C.'s flood map, if you look at New York City's flood map, if you look at Boston and all of the cities on the coast, there is a huge potential for damage and loss of life for on the continental United States from these type of storms.
Yeah, I think this has to be, as if we haven't had enough warning already, I think this has to be just a huge warning to state, local, and even the federal government of things to come, especially in coastal communities, as you were just mentioning. How are governments going to go about justifying building infrastructure to try to prepare for something like this? Can you really protect the New York City subway from a hurricane this size? Can a city like Miami, which is right on the edge of the water, really prepare itself and really defend against this? How high does a wall have to be? How deep does it have to go to make this work? These are questions that really need to be answered. And there are some places where maybe we just should not consider living anymore.
Right. And unfortunately, it seems to be the area that everybody wants to live in. If you think, the view of the ocean and that sort of synergy between the human race and the ocean. But you're right. It is no longer safe. Joe, one of the questions that you put to me, I think, is really important. Hopefully, if Dorian isn't as severe on the states, that we can shift resources relatively quickly. Things like the USS Mercy or any of the hospital ships that we have available, anything that we could do to move resources in to help the Bahamian government, because right now their airports are underwater.
What about cruise ships who make a huge profit off of the Bahamas? Why aren't they moving in? That would provide food and shelter and could be done easily. You don't need an airport, and there's lots of water.
So it's not unusual to start to see cruise ships used almost as floating, I don't want to call them hotels, but floating shelters. You still have the issue of supply. And believe it or not, a full cruise ship would need to be resupplied almost every day. So that idea of that logistics pipeline is going to have to be put into place.
I also did hear a spokesman from one of the companies saying that it's also it's dangerous to go in right now because there's so much debris, there's so much around, you don't know what you're getting into.
You can't see. I mean, you can't see what's under the water. And this is part of the challenge that the community is going to have as the water recedes, that you're going to find more bodies, for both human and animal. You're going to find wreckage that if you walk on that will cause injuries that you don't have hospitals to care for. And in both places, in Grand Bahamas and Abaco, I don't think they even have the ability to establish a land-based hospital system there. Joe, one of the things that I know we were going to we may talk about is the issue of the money from the Pentagon going to the wall. In my perfect world, the money that the Pentagon obviously doesn't need so that it could be put to the wall should be diverted to help Bahamas, because that's what we do with our neighbors, that we help them in times of need the same way they would help us.
Is there precedent for that in the sense of sending Pentagon money to help?
The Pentagon, I don't know if there's precedent in the sense of money taken for the wall to be sent somewhere else, but I can tell you that resources from the Pentagon are used during a disaster. This is also where the Pentagon works with our State Department and USAID. But the best resources right now, the most available resources, will be the military. So the idea of, you know, you start to think about the ships and capacity in the Navy, so you can actually bring in not just the hospital ships, but other ships that you can actually use as generation for both water and electricity. You start to think about the Air Force capacity. Right now, it sounds like it's the CBP and Coast Guard. So Customs Border Protection and Coast Guard are flying a lot of missions. They're going to need downtime to keep their helicopters going, so the military can play a role there. But the military can play a huge role, and frankly, I think we have to get in there to help. And the quicker we get in, the better off we are, the more lives we'll save.
Well, I was just looking to see if there's any kind of real response from the leaders of our country here in the United States about how we might be going about providing assistance. And I'm not seeing a lot of conversation out there about it. Maybe there's things happening, you know, behind the scenes. I hope so.
I would think the Coast Guard is involved. But
well, I would think they would be. As you're mentioning, it may be too dangerous right now. But I would think that this is serious enough, if what we're seeing is true, that large-scale evacuations may just be necessary. It may just be necessary to remove people from the area because there is no way to immediately deal with making it livable. And how is that going to happen, and what role will the United States play in that? And will we allow these individuals to come to our country?
Let's take a break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk right after the short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo is right there. There she is, Rosemary Armeo, Bob Griffin, Chris Churchill, and Terry Gibson. Alan, you were just starting to say when I had to move on to a break.
I was. I a couple of things. First of all, I wanted to tell you that you're off the hook as far as not introducing Rosemary was concerned, because you had, I remember distinctly, a conversation with Rosemary during those introductions. So yes, Joe, you did the right thing.
You don't have the right to let him off the hook. Only I can do that, Al.
Good.
Here's the difference as far
Rosemary.
As I'm concerned.
Yes.
One of you signs my paycheck, and it's not you, Rosemary.
You know, Joe, I was sitting here thinking exactly that. And I said, nah, shut up. Okay. Number two, I was fascinated with Rosemary's very good observation that maybe people shouldn't be living there. Now, I know after Puerto Rico, a lot of people left and have not come back. But I do think that it's easier said than done to say, okay, everybody should just leave. As you know, Al Gore, in his seminal Nobel Prize-winning film, showed how Manhattan was going to be underwater eventually. And I think to some degree that's right. So either we could be remedial, and I know Chris might have something to say about this because he's very remedial.
What do I do to deserve that? I'm just sitting here enjoying myself.
Nothing. I thought I'd just take a slide.
Joe won't protect you.
So the idea is that, you know, we're going to have to figure out where the walls are going to go. I mean, the Dutch and all the rest, they figured that out years ago. There are things we can do, and we're going to have to do them. But the idea of just saying, Rosemary, we shouldn't have anybody out there, you're right. But I don't know how you just say poof, you're gone.
Well, it's not up to us, anyways, right? I mean, that's a decision for them to make. And as Robert said, there are, you know, generations upon generations of families that have lived there. They don't want to go anywhere. They have a unique culture there. The broader point is accurate. We are going to have to start thinking about how we live along the coasts, and we're probably going to have to start changing the way we do it.
And in Manhattan, by the way, I'm sorry, Rosemary, in Manhattan, they're building out into the bay. You know, it's not as if we're doing anything except extending where we can live.
Well, also, I think, you know, we have to keep in mind that along many coastal communities, both in other countries and certainly in our own country, you have communities that simply cannot afford to relocate. They really don't have any other choice but to live there. Right. And this is where we get into, you know, the great inequality in our country and other countries as well, I suppose.
And in the world.
There are whole countries disappearing, not just communities. Bahamas is one, but the Maldives, Bangladesh is at sea level and disappearing rapidly. And global warming, climate change, is a global problem. And the first step, this is like the 12-step program, the first step is acknowledging there's a problem. And we have not done that in this country. We pulled out of the Paris Accord, which was really a first step to prevent it from getting worse, not to prevent what's happening now. Yeah. And we haven't even done that. So I don't see any, I don't see a whole lot of hope for this. But if I were living, and this is odd because I do own a coastal property, and I bought it knowing the danger, but figuring, okay, maybe I'll get 10 years out of it. And I think that I would like to see money going into infrastructure on the coast, on research on desalination for when communities like the Bahamas are just inundated. We're not doing any of that.
Yeah, to say nothing, Rosemary, of Fire Island.
Exactly. God, what if we lost Fire Island?
But, you know, and this is...
What would Alan talk about?
Going slightly off... but not really, but our willingness to want to be where it is, quote unquote, pretty and by water.
Sure.
But even in this community, in this region, you see people develop right on the rivers, and you drive by and you watch them build the houses, and then you think to yourself, gee, I remember covering a story there when that whole area was underwater. Like 5 years ago, how did that get approved that that's okay? And you see that all the time. And I wonder where the common sense less logic comes in to say, oh, I think we should put people living in the middle of a river.
Well, you know, we could talk about the stupidity of flood insurance, too. And it's not stupid to build in those places if you can get cheap insurance subsidized by the government that pays you back when you are inundated. And that is the situation in too many places along
the coast
right now.
But if you know you're
going to
be inundated.
Yeah, you just take it as a fact of living, as a fact of living in a beautiful place.
Well, there's always that very interesting thing. You take some of the... Long Island communities that always in the New York Post where everybody goes and all the rest. So the rich, the very rich, have very little to do because when it's all over, they'll just move up to the Berkshires.
Right.
Well, just in the
don't
summertime.
You see?
Safety. Safety.
Don't you see?
But Alan's point is a very real point. A lot of the places where we see people building closer and closer to water features that are destined to be underwater at some point in time, they have the resources to move and relocate if it doesn't work out. And that's oftentimes why it's approved and why it happens. They're building out in Manhattan. Who can afford to live on anything in Manhattan, much less the new places they're building out in the ocean? Mm-hmm. People that can afford to move if it happens to be underwater. So it's... Yeah. There really is an income inequality feature happening.
And that's where you start to see the problems like in Haiti after the problems that Haiti's had. Because of that poverty, it's almost impossible for the community to rebuild or to rebuild well. Mm. So when you say, well, how do you see these patterns over and over again of communities being wiped out? It's because they don't have the resources to rebuild, but they don't have the resources to move their populations. So they're actually really stuck there. And I was really – when I was watching the damage – you know, some of the initial feeds of the from the Coast Guard, I was struck by the sheer amount of damage and what's going to have to be moved in order to even begin to be able to get resources into some of these places. And I was thinking just in my mind, a quick look at the how long that's going to take versus how long you're going to be able to stay alive. And it's a real race. It's a real race.
We have some letters, and in fact, the first one is about insurance. Gary says, won't the insurance companies prevent future building because of these storms?
No, they'll just charge a lot more money where they'll make a dollar.
Well, you know, as Rosemary was saying, it's federally subsidized, a lot of flood insurance is. I mean, if people actually had to pay the actual rates, a lot of coastal living would become very unaffordable.
Correct.
Jay says no climate change mitigation until population growth and lifestyle downsizing are addressed. Technology alone will not save the planet. Climate deniers, says Rick, I hate to sound cynical, but have you thought about all of these climate deniers and what their motives might be? Development. From the Koch brothers and Trump right down the line, most of the climate deniers have an interest in development and building products. My suspicion is that they're looking at the next gold rush. Thoughts from the panel?
I think it's a really interesting, you know, it's an interesting email. I do think that there is very short-term gain for a lot of these folks at the expense of our children's and grandchildren's future. So that a lot of the work, I mean, a lot of the work that we had started in the federal government when I was in the federal government on things like the effects of climate change, even on homeland security and national defense, has been shelved. So we've lost 4 years of research that could have helped point, really show some of the true impacts of this. But I do agree with the writer that there's there are people who are playing for very, very different stakes, and it's going to cost us all.
Well, all of the regulations that the Trump administration is rolling back in the EPA are really all about short-term gains for a limited number of individuals and corporations. We'll benefit from that, but in the long run, we will suffer.
And that's
including the president of the United States, by the way.
And that's the gold rush. And because by the time we are able to identify the true impact of the impact of rolling back those regulations and change it, so much damage has been done that we're never going to regain that space.
Got this letter from Kiko who says, thanks for talking about relocating the vulnerable population. It seems crazy that Andrew Yang is the only candidate proposing plans about this, and he's getting criticized for it, being criticized for saying it's too late to reverse climate change.
He is amazingly blunt about this topic. I've listened to him talk about this, and he's very straightforward and very clear. He believes it's too late, that we have to start accepting reality and going about a government-subsidized relocation and accept the fact that some places are just not going to be habitable anymore. He's very blunt about it, and it's an interesting perspective.
And also,
we don't reward our politicians for being blunt, and I'm thinking honest.
Yeah.
Think of Hillary Clinton saying, to coal miners, your jobs are gone. We're going to retrain you and give you new jobs. But all they heard was Hillary Clinton wants to eliminate coal mining jobs. And I think she was after the same thing. And AOC is running into the same thing. It's very difficult to speak bluntly about how catastrophic what we are facing really is.
Although
people want optimism.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but there were 20 candidates, and Andrew Yang is one of the 10 who will make that debate stage because of his polls and because of the money.
He's also a genius using the internet, using electronic.
And one can only hope that that when somebody succeeds Donald Trump, that there will be a place for Andrew Yang.
Well, Andrew Yang is also appealing to a younger generation of voter who actually, I think, does have a better connection to reality and is beginning to understand that they're living in a world that's very different than their parents and grandparents, and that sacrifices and a change of lifestyle is necessary. And they are changing their lifestyle.
I mean, I love Andrew Yang. I really do. But, I mean, he is only at 2% of the polls, right? It's not like he's setting the world on fire or like his message is really connecting. And I think
but he's doing better than
– He's doing better than Kirsten Gillibrand.
Right.
I was going to say that.
He's a sign of things to come, I think, in the political world of the United States.
Very interesting ideas. And it's nice to have a candidate who is trying to provoke thought as much as they are.
In addition, I just want to say that there was an interesting article in the paper today about how AOC is being replicated all over the place in terms of a lot of people saying, "What the hell? I'll just run for Congress," and a lot of people are doing it and following that model. That's interesting too in terms of young people.
Yes, let's take a break. When we come back, we have many more topics to discuss. I don't know. World's kind of going to hell, so we have a lot to talk about. We'll be right back.
Optimism. Optimism.
The Munsters or Fallout Boy? What is Oh, The Simpsons. The Simpsons. Okay. The Simpsons. Very cool. Who's Danny Gatton playing? Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay. So I mentioned some of the stories. The two stories that broke overnight that I want to talk about just quickly. Google will pay $170 million to settle charges it illegally collected data that violated kids' privacy on YouTube. So here is what happens. $170 million to settle allegations that illegally collected data about kids younger than 13 who are watching toy videos and TV shows on YouTube. State and federal officials made this announcement this morning, part of a record punishment that some in government criticized as too lenient. Regulators charged that Google knew certain YouTube channels were popular among younger viewers, touted this fact to brands and advertisers, and tracked kids' viewing histories for the purpose of serving them targeted advertisements, ultimately raking in millions of dollars as a result of its repeated violations of federal children's privacy laws. In response, Google agreed to the record fine to resolve charges with the Federal Trade Commission and the Attorney General of New York, which are set to announce their findings at a news conference in Washington today. The tech giant also must adapt its business practices, halting data collection on YouTube videos that are clearly created with kids in mind and requiring video creators to label content that's intended for young audiences. My obvious question is, how's this different than Saturday morning cartoons that I grew up with?
Well, they didn't. They weren't tracking your yeah. I mean, it's a fair point though, because
they were selling me all that sugar coated cereal.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
but you could turn the channel. You could change the channel.
Well, you can turn off YouTube.
You could turn it off.
To be honest with you, I didn't know that
was
illegal for them to do that.
Saturday night television. It's illegal now. It was not illegal there. That's one thing.
Well, it's still not illegal on Saturday morning TV. But
yeah, exactly. Right. But so that's the difference.
To be honest, I didn't know this was illegal. This is Google's business model. I just thought that's what they did.
And the difference also is technological. On television, you're right, Chris. They cannot track the age of a child, specifically what they want, their views. I mean, I think my granddaughter must be profiled in one of this. She's watching all those lovely little shows on YouTube. They are really addicted to it.
Yeah,
they can track anything.
Anyone with a toddler around and an iPad knows that that's what they're watching on
these
YouTube
videos.
That
is what they're watching. But I have to tell you, I loved, my favorite thing to watch, because I'm so old, were the test patterns.
What?
Don't you remember? Yeah. There was nothing on. So when there was nothing on, they
need to watch
Peppa Pig. I thought you were doing something else there for a second.
It's just a static image. Right?
57 channels and nothing on.
No, but of course. Is he on the program after that comment?
But of course.
And if you kept staring at it long enough, they'd play the national anthem, and then something.
Then just
something would come on. Yeah.
But of course, we all know that they can track, right? They can track television in the same way that you can be tracked on these other things, because they're smart. They're very smart, and they know they can poll, they can find out, and they do.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to figure out the difference in doing this on YouTube and just doing it on your typical sort of Google feed as you're searching for something on Google.
I mean, so they say
one
YouTube,
way or the other, they're tracking you.
They said YouTube touted its popularity with kids to prospective corporate clients,
which is what every television network does, right?
Yeah, when it came to
you sell eyeballs.
When it came to complying with COPPA, I'll find out what that means. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act is what that means. Did you know that right off the bat? You did. Okay.
I didn't.
No.
He researches.
Okay. The company refused to acknowledge that portions of its platform were clearly directed to kids. There's no excuse for YouTube's violation of the law. That is from the FTC chairman, Joe Simons. The settlement accepts many of the claims raised by more than 20 consumer and privacy groups in an April 2018 complaint and echoes years of concerns that YouTube had become the most popular site for children while sidestepping the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And this goes back to what Rosemary was saying from the very beginning. The difference between then and now is now it's illegal.
So, but it's also much more invasive than the TV was in the 1970s. And I think, I'll be honest, I also don't think that the fine is hefty enough. I think Google still made money off of doing this, which have a problem because it's still an incentive to do it. We just brought on a new faculty member whose area of interest is cybersecurity, but it's for internet toys. And how safe are the toys that, you know, those cute little teddy bears that you bring in and they can talk to your toddler? The fact that they are hackable and who is hacking and who is watching your children. And while I'm not necessarily making a direct connection, I am saying to folks at home, make sure you understand
who is getting the data, particularly for your kids, because they can tailor it so closely now to your children that it's completely invasive.
And like the smart speakers, there's a concern because they talk back and forth to the child, and then again, they're collecting all of that information allegedly.
They're listening. They're listening in, and the same thing that makes it wonderful to be able to order. Is giving these private corporations more insights into your life than government would ever have.
And if you watch the movies late at night on Showtime, then they come off the shelf and kill you in the middle of the night.
So my question is, I'm so sorry for this, but I assume that if I have this question, so do other people. What is an internet toy again?
So an internet toy, these are toys that are connected through the internet. So they're
like Bluetooth.
They're sort of little robots. They look like dinosaurs. They look like teddy bears. They can talk to you. They can interact with your child. But they're creepy as hell once you start to take the
sun goes down.
Yeah. I mean, once you realize that, you know, it's a camera and microphone that you are putting in your child's bedroom.
I don't understand why people buy that stuff, to be honest with you.
And the same thing is true.
I have an Alexa at home, and I'm very afraid of it.
An Alexa would be considered an internet toy, really, for adults, right?
Exactly. But, you know, you as an adult make that decision. The child doesn't. That's where this vulnerability is.
Exactly.
And you know, with your iPad, and listen, I understand, you know, it's a great pacifier for your kids, especially when you're traveling. But at the same time, make sure you understand, you know, where that data is going and who has the potential to view.
Turn off the autoplay on YouTube. I mean, because YouTube will it'll be video after video after video. And if you're not closely paying attention, you don't know what the next video is and the next video is. And they can go off in weird directions that, as a parent, you're not necessarily expecting.
Why are you watching reruns of Merv?
Okay, so I'm sorry again for having to ask these sort of naive questions, but I know that we have to be concerned about this data getting out there, but what is the ultimate harm from them having the data?
So what they're doing is that they're selling your children's data, but not only that, they're targeting your children. So when you start to think about let's start with something simple as sugary cereals or sugary drinks. You know, what happens is when they get older, they start to target them with things like vaping. And this is that they put children on a track and they are bombarded with consumerist messages that I think will harm our children's long-term health.
Soon they'll be voting for
Very
Trump.
That's a very good explanation. Thank you.
Which, of course, is what advertisers have always done, which I personally think is a very good reason just for trying to protect children from advertising as much as possible.
Including in newspapers.
Yes.
Kids are not looking at newspapers. if that were a real big problem, it would be a nice
just
problem.
So you'll know, that was a shot.
Yes, I got that. Yeah.
You got the subtlety of that? Yes, all right. We have a couple of letters. Let's do those, and then we'll take a break and come back and move on to other horrific stuff. Elliot, we're talking about weather again. Elliot says it's not just the coast. The southwest United States will be uninhabitable with climate change. Too hot, no water, internal climate change, refugees. Upstate New York, climate change is the subject line of Barry's letter, who says, it has always been my view that when New York City is flooded, we can move financial capital of the world function to, say, Syracuse, great for economic development in upstate. Dave is writing about hurricanes and says the cure for coastal development is a financial one. We need to stop paying to rebuild and address after the second time. The real climate change driver, in my opinion, is that we are at about 8 billion people and will hit 9 billion in less than half the time it took to get from 7 to 8. You could conserve to almost zero, and it'll never come to the amount of energy that each person uses.
Okay, two comments. One, hence Greenland, right? Let's buy it. The other question is Syracuse. I suspect that with so much money in New York City, in Manhattan, when you take a look at the resources of the state, you better believe that the money will be spent to protect those islands, like Manhattan and Bronx and The rest of it.
Staten Island, too. Yes.
Yeah, sure. That's right. That's right, because that's where the Republicans are. So.
But, you know, Alan, but we just have to, as a society, be prepared for the fact that Mother Nature has a really warped sense of humor. And, you know, you look at a place like Fukushima, who, you know, they had a tsunami wall. You know, I believe it was an 8-foot wall, but it may have been a 6, but I believe it was 8-foot wall. What they didn't plan for was a 10-foot wave. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think as taxpayers, you know, we talked a little bit in the letter, which I think is spot on, is that the rest of the taxpayers help subsidize people who are able to buy houses on the coast. And once you stop doing that and you really look at it and you buy a property and you say, well, this is disposable, then it has a very different approach to it. But if you know the government's going to bail you out, what the hell? Why not, right?
Exactly.
I mean, sure. that's a great exactly. investment, having the government insure your property.
Sure, but you said Mother Nature. Did you mean God?
I didn't refer to her by name, but, you know.
The mother of your choice.
Yes.
As it were. Let's take a break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 7 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here, Terry Gibson, Bob Griffin, Chris Churchill, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you this morning. All right. We've been talking about the devastation in the Bahamas. We have also already talked about the ruling this morning regarding Google. I do want to talk about Brexit. We talked about it yesterday, and then a lot happened when we got off the air. And this is really something as far as trying to figure out what possibly could go next. Brexit vote went against Boris Johnson, and now he has called for an election, singular, although it could be plural by the time we're done. British lawmakers on Tuesday rose up against Boris Johnson, moving to prevent him from taking the country out of the EU without a formal agreement. The epic showdown pushed Britain to the verge of a new election. After losing his first ever vote as prime minister, Mr. Johnson stood up in Parliament and said he intended to present a formal request for a snap general election to lawmakers who would have to approve it. A little over a month ago, Mr. Johnson, a brash, blustery politician often compared to President Trump, swept into office with a vow to finally wrest Britain from the EU by whatever means necessary, even if it meant a disorderly no-deal departure. Now, Parliament has pulled the rug out from under him, and Mr. Johnson is at risk of falling into the same Brexit quagmire that dragged down his predecessor as Prime Minister, Theresa May. The lawmakers forced his hand by voting 328-301, which is really, that's significant, to take control of Parliament away from the government and vote on legislation as soon as today that would block the Prime Minister from making good on his threat of a no-deal Brexit. That prompted an angry response from the Prime Minister. Who wants to go first?
You know, I teach argumentation and persuasion in school. So yesterday, I was just glued to my laptop watching the debates in Parliament and watching the responses from the Prime Minister and from the Speaker. And
Prime Minister questions.
And it's just a fascinating experience. And I just so wish that here in this country we had a government where politicians were forced to stand before their peers and try to make their case and to take on the live criticism. But we don't do that here.
It is fascinating.
We don't have that. It's terrific, but we don't have it.
No, we don't have it.
And it has the same effect as our awful system. Nothing ended up being done other than opposition to the current idea, which is the same thing that Theresa May faced. No, we don't like that. And Boris goes, let's do this. No, we don't like that. There's no plan. There's no new idea.
What would you do?
There's no parliament plan.
What would you do, Rosemary? What would you do if you were in that situation?
I think that you're really getting very close to the idea that they have to redo the referendum. I don't see how you get around that right now.
And if that happens, what's going to happen?
well, there'll be another close vote, but at least it will be based on honestly presenting what Brexit means. Now people have spent 3 years watching that the lies and the promises made by the exiters the last time were a hoax.
The real logistical nightmares that lie ahead.
Yeah. And you also could word the referendum so that there would be alternatives on go with no deal, go with blah, blah, blah deal. I don't know. I just don't see a way around
Choose
it
your own
now.
Adventure.
I keep going back to Franklin Roosevelt, who just decided, Yalta and all the rest of it, he was taking it all away from Great Britain. They were not going to be the sovereign power that they were at the time. And that's all there is to it. And he basically said to him, we're taking all of those places away that you're controlling. And there are some old people in the country who remember it and don't want to leave it. And you have some younger people who say, hey, we got to live with what we are.
Well, the reason Brexit isn't happening at the core of it is just that there has not been a successful leader to be able to put forth a succinct message to persuade enough people that this is the way to go. And so what you're seeing, what's fascinating to me, is that you're seeing failed leadership play out on the parliament floor and the failed leaders having to stand before their peers and take criticism for it in live time to the citizens of the UK. And that just doesn't happen here. Here in the United States, when a leader fails, they do it maybe before a microphone, maybe it's televised, but yet no one is there to criticize them in live time. They can escape from the press, they can hide from the press. And then you may or may not hear their peers, other politicians, saying something. And of course, here in this country, one of the big problems is that the Republicans certainly are not coming out and criticizing our leader the way that you see in the UK.
That's a really interesting point about, and one of the things that I was heartened with is that the 21 conservatives that actually sort of crossed over, and I just learned that term about whip removed, which means they can no longer run as conservatives, and I will note that one of them is the grandson of Winston Churchill. But they stood for something that was beyond the party. And I hope McConnell and Lindsey Graham and some of these others are watching what leadership does look like. Now, I will tell you that whoever is prime minister, this is a giant burning, steaming ball of crap that I don't think there is a good there is not a good answer here. So no matter what they do, they're looking at horrible decisions. And we need to be careful in this country, because the same jingoism that got Brexit is the same jingoism that I see in the whole discussion from Cuccinelli and Miller and the whole anti-immigration folks. They haven't thought through the secondary and tertiary effects of what they're saying, and they're leaving everybody holding a steaming bag.
So you disagree that it is just a matter of leadership?
I think it's beyond leadership. I think that the UK has become so intertwined with the EU that in order to remove it, you're going to have to kill the body. One of the comments that I found fascinating in Prime Minister time was the congratulations by one of the Scottish PMs who congratulated Boris Johnson on being the last Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so interesting, because even the strong unionist supporters in North Ireland are saying we cannot go back to the Troubles. We cannot go back to a hard border. And the Scots are saying, you know, we should have gotten the hell out, you know, the last time we voted. Mm-hmm. Right. And we don't want to go down with the ship.
You are so smart.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in this idea of a second referendum is pretty fascinating.
I can leave now.
This idea of a second referendum is pretty fascinating, because I really wonder how that would go over. I mean, you're talking about a vote that was democratic, and in some sense wasn't that close compared, you know, to our presidential elections.
It was definitely fueled with lies, and there was Russian interference. That's been shown. The real problem, though, is that the same as in our country. This is a country evenly divided.
Right.
The pro and cons are so close that you're right. Even if it was a completely fair and monitored election,
it could come up with the same thing. Robert was saying about, is it possible to lead through this? When you have that kind of division, you're never going to get the kind of consensus you need to go forward with a plan that everybody can get behind. Yeah.
I mean, a leader in this case would be someone who would say, many of us are not going to be happy. But also, we have to do this for the good of the country.
Well, Bush,
and that carries through.
Bush is saying that in a sense, right? Like, I think he's fully admitting that not everybody's going to be happy with what he does, but he's says we have to go forward.
Well, Theresa May said that also.
Right.
So how important is Great Britain? In other words, we are spending an enormous amount of time on this, right? We've been talking about it virtually every day. Brexit, yes. Brexit, no. And yet, the fangs had been pulled out of this country a long time ago, a point I keep trying to make here. And yet, we are assuming that this, because of our closeness to them, because of our history with them, that they are still very, very important.
I don't know that they are very important on the world stage, but they're important to us. You know, obviously,
yeah, exactly.
We have a cultural history and they're a close ally.
They're not an empire like they were pre-World
they
War II.
Are.
However,
they're enormous
traders. They're incredibly important in the EU. That's why Brexit is so important to all of Europe. And they're the major partner with the United States in the East-West division. So I think it's wrong to say it's an unimportant. It's like Sudan splitting apart.
No, but
who cares?
I think that
we give them more
importance than they probably deserve. But it is also true that London is a global banking center and a global finance center.
Yeah, but they truly are our closest allies. Mm-hmm. When you look at what we call the Five Eyes, UK, mm-hmm. Canada, Australia, mm-hmm. New Zealand,
right.
You know, they are sort of with us this core of an alliance that has lasted since the First World War.
And that will continue to be true.
Well, it is, but when you're talking about looking at the UK potentially split, I think there is a better than 50-50 chance that Scottish independence would win given being pulled out of the EU right now. It continues to destabilize our closest allies. At the same time, you're starting to see a resurgence of Russia, and you're starting to see a growing and threatening China, and frankly, a growing and threatening India, if you start to think about the Hindu mm-hmm. nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
It is a really unsafe world out there right now, and we need all of the allies that we can get. And when our strongest ally has been so degraded because of this Brexit situation, it was brilliant on behalf of the Russians.
So if you were Scottish,
yes.
Would you vote to get out?
Yes, because I would. Because if you look at what the EU provides, the typical Scot and services versus what the United Kingdom does, they lose enormously in Brexit. They lose enormously in Brexit.
I don't like it, but I certainly agree with you. That's what I do.
Yeah.
I also think the UK, watching what happens there, is sort of an experiment. It's sort of a microcosm of what could happen in the United States. I mean, it's obviously a much, much, much smaller country. But the issues they're facing, especially around immigration, are extremely similar to the issues that we're facing here.
What do you mean? I mean, do you see the potential for the United States splitting up?
Well, I just think that they're dealing with very much the same issues. It's a divided country, and watching how this small country deals with their divisions, I think, is going to give us some lessons in how to deal with ours.
Yeah, it is interesting to see how the parliamentary procedure, the legislative procedure, has broken down because there's not a clear minority and majority. And that is what's similar to the United States.
Yep.
I think you're right.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I think he's wrong, and I think you're wrong. And here's why. If the Scottish vote goes against Great Britain, they're out. If the Irish vote, they're out. I don't see that in the United States. Do you?
Well, that's no. But what Terry is saying is that some of the same issues are at play, and part of that is this globalization, and there's kind of a global backlash to it, and some of that is justified, and some of it is not justified. But the issues are inherently the same. We're very similar, aren't they?
Yes.
No. I mean, the ultimate here is that Great Britain will split apart. I don't see that happening in the United States. I mean, we can be at odds. We'll have an election. In my view, Trump will probably lose. I have changed on that. I hope that that's the case. But I don't see – there's no civil war here.
You're taking it too literally. I don't think the United States has the same sort of history that it would break
and
apart.
And Scotland isn't a state.
There is this a lack of ability of the legislative process to handle a close disagreement. And that's what we're talking about.
And the UK has also failed to build relationships with its neighbors, and that is creating much of this conflict. The United States is now currently failing at building good relationships with its neighbors, and that's adding to our conflict. And so I just, and there's some similarities there, although the governments are obviously very different.
And it failed to include all of its citizens in the benefits of globalization, right? I mean, it left a lot of people behind.
Both countries did that, yes.
Right, and when you leave people behind, you're going to get a backlash, and that's what's happening in Great Britain, that's what's happening here, and that's what's happening around the world.
Well, I agree with all of that, but I still think it's not the same. I think the comparison is, well, for want of a better word, inept.
Well, I think that if you're in the legislature, if you are in the legislative branch of the United States government, if you're in Congress, you should be looking at Great Britain right now and see, you know, this is what can happen to a country that cannot find a way to unite around a common message. Mm-hmm. This is what can happen to a country that cannot find a way to unite around a common cause of moving their country forward and doing what's in the best interest of everyone.
What's going to happen? I don't get that.
Deadlock. Deadlock. Gridlock. Well, I mean, for 3 years, Britain had the UK has done nothing but debate to no end Brexit and has not moved forward with any other plan.
Absolutely true.
And we're focusing on building walls right now. I mean, all we're doing is trying to isolate ourselves more and more and more from other countries.
Yeah. But what I'm saying, what's the ultimate sanction? We know what it is in Great Britain. It can, Scotland can go, Ireland can go, and probably will. And in this country, you'll have another presidential election in 2020.
Yeah, but that election might be corrupt. It might not go as it traditionally does.
And then what?
Well, it begins to be the disintegration of our government, which is what's
happening
in the UK. So there are similarities.
Well, good luck to all of you.
Thank you.
Well, we're on our own. One of the patterns that we have to watch, though, is that this isn't just endemic to the UK. If you look at what's been happening in Spain, you start to see almost a breakdown of all of our traditional allies to almost the sort of sub-feudal level, which is going to have enormous implications as far as our economies, as far as our treaties, particularly our defense treaties. It will have an enormous effect. I thought one of the interesting questions that came out of the Prime Minister questions the other day was the concern that the members of Parliament had about privatizing national health. I thought that was really interesting, particularly selling NIH to an American company, and that set off a lot of finger pointing about how we are not going to be, the UK is not going to be a pansy or a sub-state to Trump in the United States. So you start to see fraying of the relationships, not just within the United Kingdom, but also creating tension with us in that respect.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to end there. Any last words? Anybody have anything? No?
I say good luck to all of you.
All right.
Thank you.
That's my last word.
We appreciate that.
Well, why do we need good luck? Don't you need it too?
Yeah, well, I'm dispensing.
Oh, just because you're right?
As Joe said, I signed a paycheck.
Ah. Or at least mine.
Let's hope.
The rest of you are on your own.
Let's hope that he does sign your paycheck.
I always hope that. Thank you all. Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We will continue with more Roundtable and Dan Rather coming up at 10:30. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.